In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is First to Know the Nature of Things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think, I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shack at the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day. Thanks for your time in listening to Democracy Sausage, which comes to you each week from the ANU. I'm Mark Kenny, and with me, as always, is Dr. Maria Teflaga. And of course, we're both from the ANU, Australia's National University. Hi there, Maria.
Hello, Mark.
I'm really thrilled to be talking this week with one of Australia's most outstanding academics, Professor Ben Saul, who just last week took up his post as UN Special Rapporteur on the Protection of Human Rights and Countering Terrorism. Quite a time to be doing that. Professor Saul is also Chalice Chair of International Law at the University of Sydney. He's written 20 books. He's an Associate Fellow of the International Centre for Counterterrorism at The Hague, and numerous other things. Ben Saul, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Pleased to be with you.
It is quite a time to be taking up this role. I guess it was in the works for some time before it got announced, but it's come at a time when those two issues, human rights and countering terrorism, couldn't be more salient.
That's right. I mean, obviously, counterterrorism has been a big feature for the last 20 years since 9/11, and states continue to make all kinds of counterterrorism laws all the time. Many states are also fighting armed conflicts of various kinds against terrorists, from West Africa through to the Middle East. So it is a difficult time, and this is a particularly catastrophic conflict, I think, for the protection of civilians, as we've been seeing over recent weeks.
It may indeed be a catastrophic time for both of the nations involved, or one of them's formerly a nation and one of them wants to be recognised as a nation, that being Palestine. But it's not a good time for Israel as well, and may prove to be a disastrous time for Israel, just as it is proving to be an existential crisis for Gazans caught up in the middle of this. They are subject to, there's 2 million of them in the Gaza Strip, Palestinians, and they are subject to, I guess, two things that are related. One is the attack, the bombardment, an aerial bombardment and our ground invasion, but also to a siege, which is denying them access for the most part to the basics of life, water, food, safe shelter, fuel, which is vital for a whole range of things, not least being the generation of power to run hospitals and for, you know, ambulances and for other things, for cooking and the like, given that infrastructure has been absolutely hammered. I wonder if we could start really by talking about the legal basis of those two things. I know the law of war necessarily is not necessarily your sort of specific specialty, but they are two separate things, aren't they? The campaign itself, Israel, whether Israel has a right to defend itself and whether this constitutes self-defense in its attack on Hamas and its attempt to eliminate Hamas, and quite separately, whether the siege of this territory with those harsh conditions has any basis in law.
Yeah, a lot of issues in there. And let me start with international humanitarian law, which governs the conduct of hostilities once fighting breaks out. So regardless who started it, who was an aggressor or a victim, international humanitarian law applies, and the rules apply equally to both sides. Now, something like a siege or a blockade of a territory is a long established and can be a lawful tactic of warfare, but there are critical constraints on how sieges can affect civilians. So if a territory is blockaded, there is always an obligation to allow the rapid and unimpeded flow of humanitarian relief and medicines necessary to ensure the survival of a civilian population. That's not negotiable. You can never just shut down a border completely, impose as the Israeli defense minister announced at the start of this campaign, a complete siege allowing no food, water, fuel, etc., into the territory, because that's just a disproportionate impact upon civilians. Even if you're fighting a war of self-defense, you can't fight that by starving enemy civilians on the other side. Now, that used to be okay. I mean, in fact, earlier under the law of armed conflict, total siege, and including if that starved civilians, was permitted, actually. But over the years, governments around the world have realized that it's a minimum condition of our humanity, that you can't fight the other side by deliberately starving their civilians. And in fact, the modern law also recognizes deliberate starvation as a war crime. It's not just prohibited by the law, it also attracts criminal responsibility for those who impose it, including the military and political leaderships. On the other side, in terms of the conduct of the fighting, the campaign itself, there the rules seem quite straightforward, but obviously in their application, there can be a lot of more difficult issues. I mean, very roughly, you cannot deliberately target civilians. You must only target military objectives. So that means fighters as well as military facilities, equipment, munitions, and so on. If you are targeting a legitimate military objective, you can't launch that attack, even if it is a military objective, if it would cause excessive civilian casualties relative to the military advantage. So that means you've got to weigh up the importance of the military target against how many civilians, property and people, injury and death, would result from that targeting. A third rule I'd mention, because that's also important in this campaign, is that you can't launch what we call an indiscriminate attack. So that means an attack where you might use a weapon or a method of warfare, which by its nature cannot distinguish between a military target and civilians who might equally be struck. So a good example is something like using very high explosive munitions in a very confined, densely populated urban area where you know civilians haven't all been able to evacuate. And in certain circumstances, even if you are trying to strike a military objective, you're likely to equally hit civilians in circumstances like that. So these are the rules which both parties are bound by. And obviously, we've been seeing that play out in over 11,000 Israeli strikes in the past month.
That's really interesting, Ben. I suppose I have two follow-ups, one that's a bit more technical and one that's a bit more general. And the first is, like, if I understand it, like, when you're talking about military targets and their proximity to civilians, you know, is this the correct understanding? Like, if the target is deemed a legitimate military target and there are civilian casualties, like, they don't actually get counted as civilians, right? Like, they basically become collateral damage because the military target was deemed legitimate. Is that like some of the sort of technical basis for how these laws are actually operating, or have I got this sort of wrong?
So it's not quite how it works. I mean, they're absolutely still civilians, but the international law of armed conflict tolerates some civilian casualties in a strike on a legitimate military objective. So the critical question is, before launching that attack, based on the information that you have, and there are what we call precautionary obligations to seek out adequate information so that you are targeting based on the relevant facts. The critical question then is, if you went ahead with that attack, would it cause excessive or disproportionate civilian casualties? Now, that's not an easy rule to apply because it is something of an abstract rule. I mean, it is weighing up how important is that particular military target. For example, how senior is a Hamas commander? How many Hamas weapons or munitions are in that location at that moment in time? How strategic is that location in terms of impeding approaching Israeli forces and so on? And then you've got to weigh that up against what would be the impact on civilians. So how many civilians are there? What's the value and extent of civilian property? And of course, some civilian objects are special ones, like hospitals, cultural property,
schools. All of that has to be in the mix as well when you're weighing up how important is the military target relative to the anticipated civilian casualties. So, you know, the law of armed conflict does allow civilians to be lawfully killed in certain circumstances. You cannot deliberately target them as such, but they can be lawful casualties of a proportionate military strike.
Just before we go to your next question, I just want to stay with that one just for a sec. What about, I mean, you mentioned about, and I think your formal words before was, if civilians haven't had a chance to get out of the area, what about, going to Maria's question, does it change the status of them if they choose not to leave, having been given what the aggressor or, you know, the people launching the attack would say was adequate warning? Does that change their status at all? Because that seems to be, in some ways, what Israel is arguing.
Absolutely not. And international humanitarian law is 100% crystal clear on this. I mean, a couple of rules are relevant. One is an attacker must give warning where that is feasible. And in some circumstances where, for example, the element of surprise is essential to the success of a military attack, you don't have to give a warning. But if you do, that warning has to be effective, which means it has to allow civilians sufficient time to safely move out of harm's way. Now, if civilians don't do that for whatever reason, so it might be that they've got a disability, or they're bedridden, or they're in hospital, or they've got, you know, five children and can't easily move, or there's no fuel and they can't get transport to move anywhere, or they just voluntarily choose to stay for whatever reason, including because they might think it's just not safe in the south, or they've got friends or family down there and they know there's no food there, so what's the point? They're better set up at home, and people, you know, make decisions about their own safety, and we have to respect that. If people don't move, they don't heed warnings, they are still civilians. Doesn't somehow mean they're not innocent, doesn't somehow make them Hamas fighters, it doesn't somehow mean you can't count them for the purpose of applying the proportionality rule in military targeting. Now, of course, that makes it harder for an attacking force, but of course, that's the price of being a responsible state in a modern international community that respects basic human rights. Civilians don't lose their civilian protection just because it's inconvenient for a military attacker. Now, I mentioned also other rules which are absolutely relevant here as well. Hamas has obligations not to locate its military equipment and fighters in and amongst civilians. It also has obligations to help to ensure the safety of its own population, including by helping to evacuate them where that's necessary, or to provide bomb shelters and ways of helping civilians to stay safe. I mean, it's pretty clear Hamas hasn't been fulfilling those obligations. But you also have to come at that in the context of the reality of urban warfare. I mean, most of Gaza is an urban area, and therefore Hamas has to fight from somewhere. It absolutely shouldn't be setting up, you know, rocket firing positions next to schools, and it shouldn't be building tunnels underneath hospitals. I mean, these are some of the allegations that have been made by the Israelis. But they've got to fight from somewhere in an urban area, and they've got to do that in a way which minimizes the impact on civilians. But it doesn't mean they're not allowed to fight at all, because they are in an urban warfare setting. Intermingled necessarily amongst civilian buildings and civilians who've remained there.
I mean, no, that's very helpful, and I think it's actually useful for listeners to sort of understand what the, I suppose, legal basis for these definitions that will be, you know, that if it ever faces a court, how they would actually be adjudicated, which clearly drive the discourse of some actors versus the more human way of understanding what a civilian is, right? That's not a legal definition. And I suppose, you know, you've kind of already alluded to this around some of the actions of Hamas, you know, and we shouldn't forget that this all started when they basically went on a killing spree. Yeah, like, you know, effectively a modern-day pogrom of extraordinary and terrifying violence. You know, like Hamas is not the same class of actor as the Israeli state. I think everyone kind of understands that. So, I mean, I suppose in terms of the realities of how these conflicts play out and how these decisions are going to be practically implemented, how does that difference in these actors, their motives? They're clearly both playing to their strengths. You know, like, how does that actually play out on the ground? And what's a useful way, I suppose, of thinking about what is actually kind of going on and how it relates to the law of war?
Well, what I would emphasize is that international humanitarian law is designed to address all forms of fighting and a whole spectrum of different actors. That includes non-state actors, whether you call them terrorists or rebels or insurgents or militants. And there is, as you suggest, a whole spectrum of different kinds of actors in armed conflict, as there is on the state side. I mean, there are, you know, responsible states who very carefully apply the rules of armed conflict. And then there are states which are completely rogue and commit far worse violence than even terrorist actors do, because they've got the capacity, the resources to do that, and you know, they've got the instrument of a state at their disposal. So I don't know that we should necessarily think of terrorist organizations as so far apart from state actors necessarily. I mean, remember when modern international humanitarian law was written, you know, in the 1949 Geneva Conventions. These were treaties written by the states which had emerged from the Second World War. This is a war which killed 80 million people. It involved facing down Nazism and fascism and all kinds of very nasty guerrilla insurgent campaigns as well, with devastating impacts on civilians. So I don't think people should imagine for a moment that somehow international humanitarian law is unrealistic. It doesn't take into account the full spectrum of security threats that the world has faced. I mean, the world has been in a worse spot than we are at the moment, right? And those rules were very deliberately written as a kind of delicate balance between, on the one hand, absolutely allowing militaries to fight and win and use a very broad spectrum of violence to achieve that, and on the other hand, to ensure there's a balance to protect completely innocent civilians, including civilians who are deemed enemy populations and in a sectarian or polarized political framework where there's lots of political pressure not to respect the rules. I mean, we see that on both sides, a ton of inflammatory and even genocidal language emerging from senior leaders on both sides of this conflict. And under those conditions, of course, it places enormous strain on respect for international humanitarian law. Israel does have a very professional group of international humanitarian lawyers. They've been considering these issues of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency for many, many years. But, you know, militaries take different views on what the law requires and how flexible the law is in interpretation. And, of course, there is some boundary pushing going on there as well. One of the difficulties is, you know, without knowing more about the information available to Israel in each particular strike, it is really hard as an external observer to draw conclusions about whether that strike was lawful or not. At the same time, there are at least some strikes on the Jabalia refugee camp, on hospitals, ambulances, which do seem very hard to square with the careful application of the proportionality and or indiscriminate attack rules, which I mentioned earlier, because there does seem to be a toleration for civilian casualties, which most other responsible militaries around the world, including the Australian Armed Forces, would just not tolerate on the battlefield.
Well, it's an interesting point. Would they tolerate them were they faced with the same, what they would regard as existential circumstances? That's kind of an unknown in a way. We haven't faced those sort of circumstances, but we might. At least theoretically, were we to do so, would we be pushing the boundaries? And that, of course, raises also the question. You talk about the you know, the law to which these states should be responsive, should have respect. But are they signatories to the ICC?
Israel or?
Yeah, Israel and the U.S. Well, if take the Israel and the U.S., for example, which is in a sense a very strong sponsor, guarantor, protector of Israel.
Yeah, so neither Israel nor the United States are parties to the International Criminal Court, but they are absolutely parties to the international humanitarian law treaties, so the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which include extensive war crimes provisions and obligations on all states to investigate and prosecute or extradite suspected war criminals. So, you know, the international humanitarian law is universal. Whether the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction to prosecute is a separate question. Palestine is a state party to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, and that's the basis on which there has been an open investigation by the prosecutor of that court since 2015. So it's a long-running investigation. And what that means is that, I mean, just in terms of how the court's jurisdiction works, it has jurisdiction over crimes committed on the territory of a state party or by nationals of that state party. So that means anything committed in Gaza or the West Bank, or anything committed by Palestinian nationals, i.e. Hamas fighters crossing into Israeli territory, is also covered by the court's jurisdiction. Just back to the first part of your question about, you know, what would we all do in an existential crisis? I challenge that assertion on these facts to start with. I mean, Hamas is not an existential threat to Israel. Israel has one of the largest militaries in the region. It's backed unconditionally by the US militarily. It's got nuclear weapons. The US has two aircraft carriers sitting off the coast of Israel. Hamas has some tens of thousands of fighters. It's got basic small arms and light weapons. It's got significant numbers of fairly indiscriminate rockets, which can't do a lot of damage in terms of serious conventional warfare to Israel. So when we talk of asymmetrical conflict, that cuts both ways, right? I mean, yes, Hamas uses terrorist methods, and that makes it difficult for Israel to counter them. But on the other hand, Israel, of course, has overwhelming military superiority. So this isn't an existential crisis. This isn't like, you know, whether Hitler would conquer England in the early days of the Second World War. It's not that order of magnitude, and therefore these kinds of arguments that international humanitarian law or human rights law is too restrictive, it doesn't allow you to protect yourself, I just don't believe that for a second. And I go back to the point I made earlier that these are rules made by states themselves in the aftermath of a conflict where everything was on the table in terms of the most terrible methods of violence and the most atrocious scale of violence imaginable. And yet they committed to this balance of the rules that we have today.
Interesting point. Look, let's take a quick break there and come back in a moment.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back. We were talking just before the break about international law and the 1949 Geneva Conventions on human rights. Ben, just a sort of a question without notice here, being a bit more historical about it, but did that in 1949, to which everyone signed up, did that immediately render a couple of the decisive decisions which ended the Second World War to have been, would have been massive breaches of human rights? I'm talking about the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Under the current law, of course, not only the atomic bombing of Japanese cities, where a very deliberate decision was made to essentially exterminate Japanese civilians to end the war more quickly, That, again, wasn't an existential moment for the West because Japan was on its knees at that point. Michael Walter, a great US moral philosopher, has dealt with this at length and makes the point that, you know, these bombs were dropped to speed up the end of the war, but not to win it. I mean, it was clear that the war was over at that point. Now, the price to American lives would have been much greater. I mean, fighting Japan conventionally, estimates suggest, you know, this could have been millions more casualties of both combatants as well as Japanese civilians, you know, going island to island, taking over Japan. So that was part of the calculus as well. I'd also mention the firebombing of European cities and Tokyo and elsewhere on both sides during that conflict. I mean, these kinds of attacks would be clearly treated as unlawful, indiscriminate attacks under the current law, because even if you were targeting it, you know, let's say some kind of shipyard or military facility within a big European city or a big Japanese city, the crude technology of bombs in those days was really so poor that you knew you were going to hit whole swathes of civilian residential areas as well. I mean, back in the day, the US Bombing Command took it as success if you hit a target 20% of the time within 300 meters of the target. I mean, that just shows you how crude these weapons were. Now, if you fast forward to today, I mean, this has, of course, been an argument Hamas has made in the past. It said, look, you know, we don't have precision-guided GPS munitions or aircraft or cruise missiles or anything like this. We've just got relatively crude, indiscriminate rockets in the way that you had indiscriminate bombs dropped from a great height during the Second World War. So, you know, we're fighting just like you guys did in the past. Under the current law, you know, that's not an excuse, right? Lack of technology, even when, of course, it's impossible for Hamas really to fight any other way because they're under total siege and blockade and the power imbalance is so asymmetric. That's still unlawful because it risks indiscriminate attack and, of course, disproportionate civilian casualties. I mean, one point I would make about Hamas fighting is that, of course, not all of its methods are terrorist in the sense that we understand terrorism to be deliberately targeting civilians. I mean, in the October 7 attacks, over 300 Israeli soldiers were killed as well, right? That's just conventional warfare and combat. And that is not necessarily unlawful under international humanitarian law. And it's certainly not a war crime under international humanitarian law. So I do think, you know, this is an issue worldwide when labeling or legal designation of groups as terrorist occurs. There is a live debate about how we define terrorism and whether that should be limited to deliberate attacks on civilians and exclude, you know, lawful methods of warfare under international law.
So is that actually currently not judiciable? Like, well, I can't remember.
Justiciable.
Justiciable, thank you. Because there is actually not a consensus on what precisely terrorism is?
Yeah, so it's, firstly, the countries have been trying to define terrorism for over 100 years without success. I mean, there's a draft treaty before the UN General Assembly in New York that's been sitting there for the last 20 years because states can't agree, including on this issue of how you distinguish combat in warfare from attacks on civilians. Now, a bunch of Western states, including Australia, have designated Hamas, all of it, military and civilian, as a terrorist organisation under their domestic laws. And under the Australian definition and some of our allies, there is no distinction made between combat and deliberately murdering civilians. So any violence by a non-state actor for political reasons against a foreign government or civilians is terrorism under Australian law. So, you know, rebels in Syria fighting Assad, you know, they're terrorists under Australian law in the same way that Hamas fighting Israel is regarded as terrorism. Because this is a what we call a non-international armed conflict, because Hamas is a non-state actor fighting Israel, they, even if they fight in accordance with international humanitarian law, so they don't kill civilians, they only target Israeli soldiers, In those kinds of conflicts, you don't get what we call the combatant's immunity from foreign domestic criminal law for lawful acts of war. So what that does mean is that under Israeli or Australian law, even if they only target Israeli soldiers, that is still the crime of terrorism, and Israel has a right to put them on trial for the crime of terrorism. If it were an international armed conflict, you know, let's say the state of Palestine is a state, instead of fighting Hamas, you are fighting the Palestinian Authority, which is the state armed force of that country. In those circumstances, it's just like, you know, Australia fighting German soldiers or Japanese soldiers in the Second World War. Lawful acts of killing give you prisoner of war status. You can't be put on trial for war crimes. You can't be put on trial under German or Japanese law for what normally in peacetime would be murder. But being a soldier in an interstate war, you get that privilege to fight without consequences under domestic criminal law.
Can we come back to the issue of the siege? The logic of that, according to Israel, is to deny Hamas, particularly if we think about fuel, but also there's, you know, been very little water get in, very little food, medicines, as you say, and a number of other things. There's been a trickle of aid getting in there, you know, since, largely due to international pressure. It seems if Israel had its way, there wasn't going to be any of that even. But they haven't let any fuel in. They say that fuel ends up being used by Hamas, therefore against them, and that they're therefore fueling their enemy. Does that then justify it under the broader power of self-defense that Israel is asserting?
So the law addresses precisely those kinds of concerns. Firstly, at the border, when humanitarian relief is coming in, and by the way, it's not just Israel, it's also other states, including Egypt, which must allow humanitarian relief in. But at the border, international humanitarian law says you can impose legitimate security controls by, like, checking trucks to make sure they're not bringing in weapons or any kind of military equipment or contraband. That's absolutely fine, and that happens already. Secondly, humanitarian relief must be provided by independent, impartial, international humanitarian organizations. So in a context like that, that generally means the International Committee of the Red Cross, the United Nations relief agencies, and their partners who they use on the ground. So this is precisely designed to avoid, you know, partisan groups saying they're humanitarian actors, but really they're, you know, sympathizing with one side of the conflict or other, in which case you get much greater risks of diversion of aid for military purposes. I mean, whether it's fuel or food, I mean, you know, the same concern is there. I mean, you could be feeding Hamas fighters if you send food into Gaza too, but we don't say you can starve everybody just so Hamas can't eat. I mean, fuel is in the same basket. Again, you've got controls on how it's delivered and where it's delivered to and who's using it. There's always a risk of diversion. I mean, you can never be 100% sure that it won't end up, you know, fueling a rocket or whatever. But if you don't do that, I mean, what's the consequence? It means hospitals can't run and civilians die because of this risk that maybe Hamas will get fuel for some rockets. That's just wildly disproportionate, and it goes back to what I said earlier about over the centuries, starvation, total siege was fine. You know, think of the Middle Ages. Think of many kind of biblical stories, some of which the Prime Minister of Israel has cited in recent weeks, where exterminating enemy civilians was considered fine. Well, it's clearly not fine, and these kinds of arguments I think should be strongly rejected. I think it is a positive thing that many countries, including Australia, have been urging the Israelis to respect international humanitarian law, to allow humanitarian relief in. I know the US Secretary of State has expressed some frustration that Israel just isn't listening to the US and it doesn't feel like it can do anything more.
What happens on an ongoing basis, it seems to me. I mean, you know, if we think about all the settlements over the years, every time a US Secretary of State visits, every time there's a flare-up on these things, we get, you know, the sort of tutting from the White House, from the State Department, wanting to reassert the commitment to the two-state solution and so forth, but it doesn't actually change anything. And we're seeing that now play out in this, in extremis, really, in this critical set of circumstances of a war. So I'm not all that surprised.
And the US suggesting it, you know, it doesn't have any more influence is clearly not true. I mean, Israel is receiving large amounts of money and military aid and equipment from the United States. The US Secretary of Defense has said our aid, our provision of weapons to Israel is unconditional. They have imposed no constraints on how Israel uses those weapons. So if the US wanted to do more, it could. Now, there are political reasons in domestic US politics why that doesn't
happen.
Can I ask you,
is there any legal dimension to that? You say the US has given these arms unconditionally and made it clear about that. Does that imply any liability for the US?
Yeah, a number of points. One is under common Article 1 of the four Geneva Conventions, so articles the same across all four of the treaties, all states have an obligation to ensure respect for international humanitarian law by other states, including when you're not involved in the conflict. Now, that's an obligation which means that if you have a relationship of special influence with a belligerent to the conflict and you've got levers to pull, absolutely, you must do that to the full extent of your capacity. But secondly, and this is even stricter, I think, all states are obliged not to aid and abet the commission of war crimes. And there is individual criminal responsibility for complicity in war crimes. So if you know that one of your allies is likely committing war crimes and you continue to provide weapons to them, which might contribute to the commission of those war crimes, then that itself is a form of criminal responsibility under international law. I saw in Australia there's a court proceeding launched just yesterday to try to get more transparency around what kinds of weapons Australia itself has been exporting to Israel, because there's really no transparency around that. I mean, the number of permits issued is on the public record, but we never know anything about what those permits are for. Now, it could be completely innocuous. It could be, you know, clothes and boots and radios or something, or it could be weapon systems, in which case, if it's at that end of the spectrum, there are then real risks. Also for Australia, because we are a party to what's called the Arms Trade Treaty, which is a fairly recent convention, which requires us, as a matter of law, not to export weapons to a country where we know they would be used in the commission of war crimes. And even if we don't know that they would be used, there's still a due diligence obligation to weigh up the risks of whether they might be used in that way and not to proceed with export if they would be so used.
So, okay, that's actually really quite fascinating. And one of the things that we sort of touched on a few minutes ago was this principle of self-defense. Essentially, what is the legal framing of this doctrine and how does it relate to the current conflict?
So the right of self-defense is a very ancient right of states. It's spelled out in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter of 1945. And conventionally, the understanding is if a country faces an armed attack from another country, it has a right of self-defense to halt and repel that attack. In exercising self-defense, you can only do what is necessary and proportionate in repelling that initial attack. So you can't go beyond it and do non-defensive things like annexing territory or punishing a foreign state or plundering its resources. I mean, these are things which have happened in all kinds of recent conflicts, Congo, Uganda in the 90s and elsewhere. So that part of the law is pretty clear. What's more difficult is that there has been a really unstable debate about self-defense against non-state terrorist actors since 9/11. There's a group of Western states, and Australia's part of this group, which says there is also a right not only to use self-defense against an attack by another state, but also an attack by an autonomous or independent non-state armed group emanating from some kind of foreign territory, even if another state is not involved in sending or controlling the activities of that armed group. And so the way the US and Australia put it is that if a foreign state is unable or unwilling to suppress a terrorist group mounting attacks from its territory, then the victim state can itself go and attack that group and defend against its ongoing attacks. Now, why I say that's controversial is because the International Court of Justice in the Israel Wall Advisory Opinion in 2004 insisted that the law had not yet changed post 9/11. And it said roughly the same thing in some subsequent cases as well. One of the reasons for that is because most of the world doesn't yet seem to accept that there is a right of self-defense against non-state actors. So the non-aligned movement, which is a group of about 120 states, so a clear majority in the international community, has been very skeptical of that widening of self-defense because they see it as a real risk of escalation of use of military force by powerful states against fairly weak and vulnerable states who may not have certain capacities to deal with terrorist groups. So this is playing out in the current conflict. So a group of principally European and states and the US have said Israel has a right of self-defense. A group of other states have refused to accept that position. And this is why there was an impasse over UN Security Council and General Assembly resolutions on reference to self-defense. The other part of this story, just quickly, is that in the 2004 Israel Wall decision, part of what the court said there was that because Israel is an occupying power in the West Bank in the circumstances of that case, self-defense is not relevant because it's already a territory that Israel has extensive military control over. The law of occupation, which is part of international humanitarian law, indeed gives occupying powers very extensive security powers to ensure its own military security in occupied territory. So nobody's saying Israel has no right to protect its citizens. The question is whether the source of that power is the international right of self-defense or just the law of occupation and the security powers already granted over occupied territory. Now, why that's still relevant in Gaza is because the United Nations regards Gaza still as occupied territory, despite the Israeli withdrawal in 2005, because they say Israel still exercises such extensive control from afar, a kind of remote control at the border over everything in that happens in Gaza. You know, its economy, the movement of people, everything that gets in and out of the territory, air, land, and sea under Israeli control. But that's still occupation. Now, quite a few military lawyers in governments disagree with that approach, and it is quite a transformative or radical approach. But if you take that approach, then you do recognize that Israel has security powers to respond to Hamas's attack.
Really fascinating. And of course, the law of occupation places its limitations on the occupying power as well. And one of those limitations is that it can't simply colonize territory that it is temporarily occupying, correct?
That's right. So the notion of occupation is a kind of trusteeship relationship. So it sounds a bit strange that, you know, you're an enemy force controlling a foreign population, but you have to act for their benefit, right? Because you've displaced their government. And therefore, you have to fulfill all of the obligations of a government to keep regular civilian life going. I mean, that means law and order, a functioning justice system, the provision of social services, and all of the humanitarian necessities of life. So it is a very substantial burden. And as you say, I mean, it is a temporary relationship. It doesn't allow you to colonize or annex foreign territory and claim it as your own sovereign territory, as Israel has done in East Jerusalem, which, you know, which is part of the occupied West Bank, but Israel claims it to be Israeli sovereign territory proper. Likewise with Syria's Golan Heights, which Israel...
But also with the settlements as well, with lots and lots of settlements right through the West Bank.
Yeah, so we think there are probably about 700,000 or so settlers in the West Bank. Now, Israel has not formally annexed those areas as sovereign Israeli territory, but what the International Court of Justice said in 2004 was that this is kind of a de facto annexation, because by building this massive security barrier, not along the green line, which is the presumptive future border between a Palestinian and an Israeli state, but instead to encircle and protect a whole series of Israeli settlements.
And arming them as well.
Yeah, effectively prejudicing a two-state solution, making it impossible for the Palestinians ever to exercise self-determination over the full extent of their territory.
Yeah. We're probably getting close to running out of time, but just finally wanted to get your response to, and in a way we've covered some of this, but I guess it's true to say legal academic colleague Alan Dershowitz in the US, he's sort of a mercurial character. He claims to be a Democrat-aligned human rights academic lawyer, but he's also defended Trump on one or two occasions. And recently he has said that, and I was astonished to read this. I mean, I saw him doing it as a piece to camera. He has said that the people of Gaza voted for Hamas, and therefore they should be regarded as supporters of Hamas, end of story. Whereas, he says, the people slaughtered in the kibbutzes of on October 7 were probably progressives. They were probably anti-Netanyahu, who two-state, anti-settlement people, and that we shouldn't be shedding tears over these Palestinians in Hamas. I mean, that strikes me as having, one, no basis in international law, which is pretty astonishing for a legal scholar, but two, morally, just an absolutely depraved position.
So morally, I agree 100%, and it echoes exactly the same arguments that many terrorist groups have made over the years, right? So if you think of French Algeria, Frantz Fanon and others, their argument always was, French civilian settlers in Algerian territory are part of the apparatus of the occupation and colonialism. And so we draw no distinction between their moral blameworthiness and those of, French soldiers on the battlefield. So we can just kill everybody. Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden said, American taxpayers finance the US military, so we can murder them, right? I mean, there's no distinction. Israel, by the way, does make that argument already. It murdered a Hamas financier in Dubai over a decade ago using falsified Australian passports, by the way, because it said, if you finance terror, you're part of the organization, right? Well, this is collapsing the distinction between civilians and military personnel on the battlefield. And it's a recipe for total war and total annihilation of civilian populations. What international law says about that is pretty clear. It says, look, if a civilian does take a direct part in the fighting, they make themselves targetable. So any civilian who picks up a weapon in an armed conflict on either side and starts fighting, they become legitimate military targets under the law of armed conflict. But you cannot target, and this is absolutely clear, you cannot target all of the civilians in the background who undoubtedly provide all kinds of indirect support to the war effort. Think of Australia during the Second World War. You had people all over the country, making weapons, performing logistics for the military effort, people recruiting, propagandizing, financing. None of that is direct participation on the battlefield. And so, yes, in war, we know we mobilize our whole societies for the war effort sometimes, but it's only if you're actually engaged in combat can you be militarily targeted. Otherwise, there's just no distinction between civilians and military people.
Yeah, yeah. It just astonished me when I saw it, because I thought that he's effectively legitimizing the very logic of the people who came over the fence at Gaza and started killing people at a rock concert, at a music festival. It was the same logic, really.
That's right. And what I'm very concerned about is the level of high-level inflammatory dehumanizing speech coming from very senior Israeli political and military leaders. So the Prime Minister cites a passage from the Old Testament where God commands the Jews to exterminate everybody on the other side, including, and they specifically mention, all women, children, men, animals, I mean, whole-scale annihilation of another civilization. We've seen other senior ministers and political and military leaders calling for another Nakba, which is what the Palestinians understand to be the catastrophe of 1948, which involved, along with movements of Palestinians to get out of the way of the war, deliberate forced expulsion by the Jewish independence fighters. You know, we've heard calls to erase Gaza from the face of the earth. We've heard calls for nuclear annihilation of Gaza from a serving minister in the government. I mean, to my mind, some of this speech is direct and public incitement to genocide. I don't think there's yet any kind of organized state policy of deliberately physically destroying Gazans. But this is the kind of early warning type speech we should absolutely be concerned about. And I haven't seen, frankly, Western leaders condemning that kind of speech, which I find just extraordinary. I mean, it's one thing to prompt Israel for more humanitarian relief quite gently in our foreign minister and prime minister's public statements. But this kind of speech should be strongly denounced by our political leadership, because if you don't do that, then you're tacitly accepting that this is an acceptable part of the political discourse.
And Maria, I suppose we know this is a highly politically charged environment. I mean, we've been talking about the legal basis of a number of these things, and that is absolutely critical, of course. But there's a whole political dimension that sort of exists awkwardly alongside it, sometimes overlapping with it and sometimes not. There'll be many people who might be listening to this discussion thinking that in some way we're glossing over atrocities enacted on October 7, or indeed before on many occasions, by terrorists, by Hamas and other terrorist groups. We're not doing that.
No, I mean, I think that's actually a really important point, because, I mean, a lot of the discourses that Ben has just pointed to coming out of political elites in Israel, military elites in Israel, are equally being said by political and military elites out of Hamas. And it's absolutely true to say that this conflict exists in a negative feedback loop of mutual dehumanization,
yeah,
right? Like,
well put.
It doesn't exist in a vacuum, and it's actually very difficult to determine where one should start the analysis, right? At which date, because the nature of this conflict in some ways is actually extremely simple. You have two groups of people that want to live on the same bit of land, but the actual bit about getting a short-term through to a medium-term plan to a long-term solution is incredibly complex for multiple reasons, but at the heart of it is this negative feedback loop of mutual dehumanization.
That's right. And I think it's also true to say that that I think history will show that the truest friends of Israel will be the people who were counseling the maintenance of law and a moral code, as well as a legal code, legal behavior and ethically and morally defensible behavior, and also who will be advocating that Israel go about prosecuting the protection of itself in a way in which it will enhance its long-term security. And at the moment, I think it's fair to say there are many, many more recruits being made of haters of Israel inside Gaza by what feels like carpet bombing to them. What's the long-term tale of that for Israel? You wouldn't think it's in Israel's longer-term interest. So, you know, they need to be much more deft, it seems to me, in the way in which they go about addressing this threat.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's been a lot of discussion around why Hamas has undertaken this these atrocities in the first place, which is to provoke exactly this kind of reaction. And I mean, I think there are sort of a few things here. Like, one, Israel's behavior is at the moment, or its response, is part of a sort of a chain of a different policy setting from the early 90s, for example, principally by the Benjamin Netanyahu's governments, right, over time, which has taken a different route away from the Oslo Accords, as one. Mm. And secondly is that the structure and dynamics of domestic politics in the sort of traditional allies of Israel is structurally different to how it might have been 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And the place of the Islamic world, its diplomatic weight, its position has changed as well since 9/11, you know, because we are actually living in an era of disorder and and disruption. And so all of these things have changed the calculus about how these things will play out and the actual effects. It's not surprising that that is really disturbing to a lot of diaspora communities, Jewish diaspora communities, around the way this debate has been conducted. And I suppose the greater visibility of the fury of other, basically of Muslim diaspora groups in countries like ours.
Yeah, and there's a lot of resistance also from Israelis, moderate Israelis, to this current government. Obviously, they're in a crisis situation at the moment. But Biden has apparently said to Netanyahu that he thinks he's right at the end of his shelf life, and there is a wide expectation from reading the Israeli press that the government won't last, and Netanyahu has his own demons to face legally, as well as answering for the catastrophic failure of intelligence on October 7. And he's one of the only people who hasn't taken any responsibility for that.
Exactly.
He's the Prime Minister.
And I think that's actually an important point, is that the nature of the debate on the ground in Israel is actually far more complex than it obviously is here, because of the nature of diaspora communities and how they relate to what's actually happening in the home territory. And we shouldn't forget, right, like this crisis hasn't come out of a vacuum. You know, Israel is a state that's been to the polls 5 times in as many years or less, where people have been weekly protesting in thousands of numbers for 10 months, where people from the security services and in the military have basically gone on strike. Like, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu's like policy of essentially ignoring this conflict whilst trying to create normalization agreements. Yeah, it was to put it in game theoretic terms, an unstable equilibria. And something was going to happen, whether or not it was this specific set of, you know, truly horrific and horrifying attacks that have sparked this, or a more typical, intifada response. In some ways, it doesn't really matter. This was not a stable policy approach.
Yes, much to change. Ben Saul, thank you so much for taking us through the legal basis of this, the history of it, and where it sits. It's a complex set of concepts, I suppose, for people to get their heads around, and it's been really great just hearing you explain them so well. And we, of course, all watch this conflict with a degree of horror, because it doesn't look like there's a great deal, as Maria was just saying, a great deal of subtlety of thought going into a lot of these things.
Thanks, Mark. And if I can make just a few brief concluding comments.
By all means.
I'd agree with you 100% that there has been genocidal speech on the other side from not only Hamas, but Hezbollah and Iran as well. And that story, I think, is well known. And one way you can legally characterize parts of the October 7 attacks is as a deliberate intention to destroy part of the Jewish people, along with a bunch of war crimes, murder, hostage taking, etc. I mean, I think one of the reasons why most of the legal debate is focusing on Israel right now is because what Hamas did is straightforward. I mean, those are just straight up war crimes. Nobody's really contesting that. On the root causes you alluded to, I think that's a really important issue, which is kind of overlooked in the current emphasis on the humanitarian situation and the live combat and all of the suffering that's going on. But the UN Secretary General was dead right to say Hamas did not rise in a vacuum, and indeed the UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy, which all states, including Israel, signed up to, agrees that one of the root causes of terrorist violence is prolonged unresolved conflict, serious human rights abuses, systemic discrimination, dehumanization of people. And if you think about those kinds of factors, they've all been present in Israel and Palestine for many, many decades. And I think what we're seeing is a culmination, entirely predictable, of the failure of the international community to force the parties to a permanent, peaceful settlement, not just a negotiated settlement, which implies that it's just a political free-for-all where whoever has the most power, you know, gets what they want, but a settlement according to the principles of international law. And that includes the fulfillment of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination, to control their own political future and control all of their lands, not, you know, cutting out the settlements, which Israel wants to keep. And on the other side, ensuring that Israel has security and isn't being destabilized by some of its neighbors or some of these extreme armed groups. And I think we've been just obviously terrible at resolving that side of things. You know, the US is the critical actor here. It clearly has been pro-Israel for many, many decades. I mean, there's no other way to read its approach. I mean, it tries to be a peacemaker, it tries to be an honest broker, but, you know, how can it be when it's providing unconditional weapons to one side and not doing much to force the hand of the Israelis. A final point just on Israeli politics. I mean, I was there in Israel in December last year during these debates about judicial reform and so on. I think we've got to put that in the context of, yes, great protests by Israelis about changes to their Supreme Court and protections primarily for Israelis. But on the other hand, you've got the complete collapse of the left in Israeli politics, the complete collapse of any kind of serious peace movement with political heft in Israel. And that tells you that most Israelis have been fine with a kind of perpetual military occupation, denial of self-determination called out by the International Court of Justice, the condemnation of settlements, even by the UN Security Council, and there hasn't been any kind of serious domestic constituency as Israeli politics has lurched dramatically to the right. And I think this is part of the story of how we've arrived at where we are today.
It may well be. I was reading in Haaretz yesterday, though, that one account suggesting that this is the end. This is the end game for Likud and for Netanyahu and for the hyper-militarized approach and using some sort of historical examples of that, the way Labor fell, I think it was might have even been in the 1960s. So we shall see. You're quite right. There are domestic political elements here that are too easily simplified as well, but things need to change. And there are forces within Israel. I was thinking of Ami Ayalon, for example, former head of Shin Bet, the National Security Service, former head of commander-in-chief of the Navy, also a former Labor MP, as I understand it. But he was saying he thinks the only way this is going to be resolved now is if the international community enforces a settlement on Israel, that he's sort of calling on the US and France and the Arab states to come together and to enforce a settlement. And he believes that Israelis more broadly would be prepared to accept this if they could get rid of their government. That's a view from inside, and it's a view from someone with extraordinary bona fides as a security official. So I think, you know, it has at least the attraction of some sort of possible future that isn't just a constant cycle of violence begetting violence, which is what we see at the moment. We're right out of time. Thanks again, Ben. It's been really terrific talking to you, and I hope our listeners have gained a great deal from it, as I have.
Thank you so much, Ben. I think that's a really useful contribution to the debate to unpick these abstract concepts.
Thanks to both of you, and great to be with you.
Until next week, bye for now.